And I'm going to start the recording here as well.
This meeting is being recorded.
Okay, so let's talk about the article a little bit. Yoni did a nice job introducing it. Chavali's not here right now. Maybe he'll join us later. You see, the article is entitled Freedom of Contract or Freedom from Contract. And basically, the two authors here, Ray Broyd and Stephen Weiner, want to argue that the halachos of Schiris Paulim and the halachos of like the Jewish rules of contract in general are diametrically opposed to the common law's rules of contract. Specifically, they want to say that the halacha shies away from enforcing contractual obligations. The halacha shies away from even creating certain kinds of contractual obligations. And their upshot, the upshot of their contention is that the halacha thinks that contractual obligations would infringe on individual freedom. And it's out of this concern for the freedom of the individual that the halacha takes a very limited conception or takes a very limited position on the enforcement and obligatory nature of contracts. That's the main point of their article. And I think that conclusion is itself controversial, but certainly the argument for the way for getting there is problematic. So let's take a look at this in turn. So they point out that they start off by observing from this cover article that we actually saw in the beginning of the year that there's this difference between the way Jewish law emphasizes obligations and the way secular law emphasizes rights. Okay. They say there's a more general conclusion to be drawn that there's the Judaic mindset of obligation and duty and the common law mindset of rights and needs. But I think they want to point out that when it comes to contracts, Jewish law is less willing to impose obligations than secular law is, than the common law is. So I think that itself should just give us pause on the cover article, whether that whole idea that Judaism is skeptical about rights and only emphasizes duties, whether that itself is true. In any event, Broyd and Weiner think that their conclusion is at odds with cover's observation that Judaism imposes obligations and doesn't really recognize rights. Okay, their core observation here, and here's just like here's some of their statements. They want to say that we shall see classical Jewish law protects freedom of choice over contractual interests. Okay, and you can see I put could everybody see if there's the note pop up on your screen also? Yeah. Okay. So I just didn't understand why they think that not recognizing a contractual agreement is almost a more consistent with freedom of choice than recognizing it. You might think that giving people the choice to enter into contracts is one kind of freedom of choice, right? I point out later in my comments that libertarians have made this argument forever. They think that states should enforce lifetime servitude contracts because individuals just have free choice and freedom to contract. And it's not this, the state doesn't have the right to infringe or to interfere with that. And so the article here it pumps the intuition that there's greater freedom of choice in not allowing people to enter into agreements. But I think that just as good an argument can be made in the opposite direction to say that contracts maximize autonomy or they're autonomy enhancing through giving people the choice to enter into agreements. So I think this even this main claim is problematic. Eitan?
Can you say the same thing? Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
Go ahead, Ben.
Can you say the same thing about the whole avadim le'avadim thing and that are you against the extrapolation of that verse and say that it's that by limiting the amount of time that you can work, that is making you into an eved, and that if you wanted really to avoid avdus and like the rabbinic understanding, then you should allow people to work as much as possible?
This is not a good... Itamar, I don't think... Itamar, sorry, I don't think you're right. The lack of a legal capacity, like, it depends where you draw the line, the lack of a legal ability to force yourself to be held, to bind yourself to be held to a certain act is like, is it admits that you are able to limit your, like, you know, or is it's like the, it's like the question, would you rather have a god who could you know, build who could create a rock greater than which, you know, he couldn't lift, or would you rather have him be able to lift the rock anyway? Like, this is not a, I'm not quite sure that this is like a productive, this baseline question probably isn't going to get us very far.
I think, Ben, I like your comment. I think you're pointing out that the halacha itself in trying to limit the number of years you could contract yourself into, seems to recognize that this borders on avdus, Ben, right? That's your point. And so it might be problematic. I would say the answer to that, I think, Ben, is that there's a distinction to be drawn between freedom of choice and not being subject to somebody else's authority. I think those are just two different conceptual and philosophical ideas. So if they were to phrase this article and say the halacha is skeptical about subjecting individuals to other people's, other person's authority, then I think that would be a good argument. I think that's what the halacha is getting at in avadahim v'lo avadim la'avadim. Notice they don't phrase it that way because they want to apply their argument to even the ability to be makne adavar shelo baliolam, the ability to obligate yourself to sell a bushel of wheat that you'll get next year. That's not subjecting yourself to somebody else's authority. That's just undertaking a contractual obligation. So Ben, I think your observation about Chazal is correct with respect to master-servant relationships. We don't want these relationships where one person is subjugated to somebody else's dominion. That's different from the way they phrase their article, which is about enhancing free choice. And I think with respect to the proposition about free choice, it could cut either way, whether allowing people to enter into contracts opens up free choice, or whether keeping people committed to their promises undermines it. Does that help, Ben? Yeah. Cole, I think that should partially address your point also.
Yeah, like the contracts do allow you to be subject to somebody else's authority, the authority of your past self. And there are plenty of theorists of identity who will tell you that, like, when you get down to the metaphysics of it, it's very controversial that you should be allowed to, your past self is different from your present self. Why should we have a, you know, a democracy of the dead in politics? Why should we have promises? Why should you have to keep promises? Now, this intuition is false, because obviously it's moral to keep your promises and immoral to break them. It's not obvious to me that the existence of a legal mechanism to contract yourself when you get down to, in both cases, you're allowing somebody to be subjected to the will of something or somebody that is not his present self.
So I have two answers to that, kol regalachas. One of them is that I don't think the halacha shares that Humean bundle of impressions, bundle of ideas, conception of the person, that it's actually concerned about the continuity of the person over time, such that it's problematic to hold my present self to the commitments of my past self. That's, I think you have like a Parfidian, Humean conception of the person.
I'm just saying in principle, the intuition, I think we're agree. I think in principle, though, the intuition is actually on the side of contracts being themselves a possible limit on individual freedom.
Okay.
Halacha chooses. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
I think my sense in defense of Freud is that when we talk about freedom of contract as a freedom, that is somewhat, abstract is the wrong word, but in terms of my tangible freedoms to do things, no one's stopping me from doing what I would do in a contract a week from now, just without having a contract to do so. So freedom of contract is this, like, sort of like step removed, sort amorphous legal power as opposed to a tangible freedom that manifests in my choices.
So Yair, you're sympathetic to Cole's point, is that? Yair?
Yes.
Okay. I agree that there's a dialectic here. I'm just pointing out that the way they spin it is far from justified when you take a broader perspective on what constitutes free will. Here again, Noah, I'll take your question 1 second. I know Eitan has a hand also. Therefore, Jewish law is uncomfortable with allowing individuals to effectively contract away their future choices. I just want to point out that, again, so that they're pumping the intuition that we can't contract away our future choices. But notice how not enforcing contracts also takes away our present choices. Meaning, if you don't have contracts, it takes away your ability to have the present choice of selling stuff that you will later get. So I think this, as Cole pointed out, it's a futile exercise to start fighting intuitions about what's choice maximizing versus choice diminishing. And they say here in this last sentence in the opening paragraph, in a sense, strong contractual obligations would weaken the foundation for strong moral obligations. I don't even know.
That just means that I saw you underline that. All that means, I think, is that if you had to, and the halacha addresses this, but if you had to perform task X, and then while you're busy performing that task X, there's some obligation, some pre-existing obligation that you didn't realize you had or whatever. So there would be a conflict between the two obligations. And so not allowing a robust enforcement of like performance obligations would free you up to care for the moral obligations you have. The response is, of course, that keeping your promises is a moral obligation.
Yeah. So Cole, that's a really interesting point. So the way Cole's reading this line is like we saw this idea in some Achronim, that Ki li b'nei Yisrael avadim, we saw this in the Pesachei Tshuva, is almost like a narrow issue to ensure that you could continue to engage in your divine worship, right? The idea is that if you have so many obligations to your master, that's going to interfere with your obligations that you have just in terms of like your Orach Chaim duties. How are you going to go to Minyan and Davin and do Daf Yomi, whatever, if you're always mowing the lawn for your master? So Cole's reading that line this way, and we did see ideas about this, that kind of idea on the Achronim. Specifically, they argued if your employment is about Avodas Hashem, you're a chazin, or you're a malame, then arguably you don't need the right to be chozer because there's no conflict between these two moral, between your contractual obligations and your moral obligations. Cole, that's what you're getting at, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. If I just want to point out, they slip this sentence in here, but notice how that's already a very different kind of argument than the argument about free choice, right? So if they're, until now they've been arguing that Judaism is skeptical about taking away person's freedom of choice by holding them to the commitments of their past selves. In this sentence here, they're shifting gears, and it's a conceptual confusion, to start talking about this religious consideration that we're worried that holding people to their past obligations will interfere with their ability to just do the mitzvot that they're obligated to do. So the first thing is about free choice. The second thing is about infringing on your, let's say, Orach Chaim duties. And so those are very different considerations and we'll have different nafka mina. Let me take some questions here and then I'll make one point before I move on. So Eitan and then Yair.
I was actually gonna say what Ben was talking about in response to your comment on the article, so we're good.
Okay, good. Excellent. Yair.
I disagree with Cole's reading. I think the right way to read that sentence is that free will is the foundation for strong moral obligations, and free will is weakened by strong contractual obligations. If we assume that intuition, then I think that's what's being referred to, and not Orach Chaim type inyanim.
That free will is the basis for strong moral obligations?
Yeah, I think that's what they're alluding to in the previous line.
Cole, do you want to respond, or?
I think it comes to the same thing. I don't think what you just said is inconsistent with what I just said. And what you're basically saying is, you know, the ability to contract your labor would bind your future self in a way that's disadvantageous to free will. All I did, I guess, in with respect to what you just said, is just fill in, like, what are the things that you're going to be missing out? What are the moral obligations you're going to be missing out on being able to perform as a result of this, you know, prior abridgment of your, you know, of your freedom of your freedom of will?
So I disagree with your agreement, in the sense that the way I understood your point, or at least the way I understood the way Itamar understood your point, was that there are specific moral obligations that are going to be missed out on if one has these other obligations. My contention is that even in the absence of missing out on any moral obligation, the notion of moral obligation is weakened when free will is weakened. And again, you can disagree with that contention, but the fewer choices you have, the less it means to make moral choices.
I would agree with your reading if they said here that strong contractual obligations interferes with robust moral accountability because the multitude of avenues of free choice that you have open to you, that's the ground for moral responsibility. But they don't say that. They don't say that it interferes with moral responsibility. They say for moral obligations, right? And that just seems like an infelicitous phrase on your reading.
Yeah, I think it's a stylistic point. You like the parallel between the phrase strong obligations.
Oh, yeah. So interesting. You're willing to diverge from the plain meaning of the text here.
I would never do this with a Rishon, but I'll do it with Freud.
Right.
I would only do it with a Rishon.
All right, Adam. Adam had a hand.
I very much like Yair's read of it. But I can even read into the sentence of, in a sense, strong contractual obligations sort of weaken the foundation for strong moral obligations. The question of the contract itself, do we view the contract as a contractual obligation itself, or do we keep the contract itself to be a moral obligation?
Yeah, that's so a cool. Yeah.
Self-contractual buys themself away from leaving the agreement, then that takes away what the true motive behind the metaphysical halakha and its application is supposed to be. It's supposed to be choice of free will. You have the free will to choose and therefore fulfill your obligations, which is the whole point of it.
So you're agreeing with Yair on this?
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay, Noah has a hand.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to make the point about Avdut and Avdut Lashem as something that could be either a support for his position, or I would think more limiting and would in fact show that him making claims about Judaism seem like moral obligations is too reductionist, because there is a machloket within positions in halacha about that. So I think that making such a claim is too reductionist. About this specific line, when I read it originally, I read it several times, I had no idea what he was talking about. I think one of the big flaws in this article is that there's too much abstraction without enough definition and refinement. I found that he did a really bad job of being able to express tort language, philosophy, halacha in a clear way. And I found it challenging to read this because he didn't do a good job of fleshing those things out.
Yeah, I think there's just a lot of conceptual confusion here, as I'll point out as we move on. But I definitely agree that there's a lot of imprecision here, which flows from, I think, both an inadequate understanding of the halakhic categories and just the basic philosophical categories. Let me make one other point, and in tune with Noah's observation, before we move on. When you read this opening statement, what do you think is the underlying problem? Meaning, what is the thing that Broid and Wiener are worried about? Like, what's in tension with halacha over here? I see Adam has a hand raised.
Yeah, I think it goes back to the rights-based and duty-based issue.
So what do they think is problematic? That the halacha would be imposing what?
I mean, would be imposing a rights-based framework for contractual law when halacha is generally duty-based.
No, so I think they think that their point, they think that if anything, the halacha is shying away here from imposing obligations, right? Look at all these statements. Classical Jewish law is reluctant to recognize and enforce such obligations. Notice the double formulation here. Anybody find this jarring? Jewish tradition is reluctant to recognize and enforce. Those are two very different issues, right? Recognizing or imposing obligations and enforcing the obligations are really distinct. Look here. Strong contractual obligations would weaken the foundation of blah, 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 blah. So they talk here at times, and you'll see this confusion throughout the article, as if the problem lies in imposing obligations, that would be contrary to the ethos of Jewish law. And at other times, and specifically their argument, is only makes sense with respect to enforcement of the obligation, right? And they teeter back and forth between issues relating to imposing an obligation and issues relating to enforcing the obligation.
It's funny. I get the sense from their article that what troubles them is actually neither of these points, either about recognition or about enforcement. It's rather about like they're basically worried about like how the halacha only recognizes contracts if there is some kind of like, you know, maisa kinyan with a property interest involved. I mean, their point is about method of contractual obligations, not really either scope or enforceability of the obligations themselves. All the examples that they give, they're not about like obligations as such. They're about like the circumstances in which the attempt to confer or undertake a right or an obligation is inadequate because like the style, what I'll call the style of kinyan, wasn't, or the object to be under contract wasn't sufficiently substantial.
They think the underlying reason for all of those scenarios is that the halacha is generally skeptical to impose obligations and enforce them. So they think those are all just manifestations of the phenomenon that they're pointing out.
Right,
look here.
Weird, but no. I realize the it just seems very, their proof texts for all of these are, and maybe you have a comment in there about Gemara's Das that I took issue with in a voice note that I sent to you, but fine, I think we're on the same side when it comes to what I'm about to say. If the halacha generally had a problem with promising, so I think you would expect like the scope of things that you can promise to do to be, you know, really narrowed by the halacha. Now the avdus point is an example of that, but most of the examples that they give, the explanandum does pop up where you would expect it to pop up.
Yeah.
That's not about promising. That's just like there's no thing. Like you don't right. lack the power. Not that the halacha doesn't want you doing these sorts of things. There's just the halacha's view is that you need like a property. I mean,
that's right.
You got to draw from somewhere, but it has nothing to do with whether you think there could be promises in general.
That's right. That's right. This is kind of my comment over here. So look what they say. So they say, Jewish law has always had a great reluctance to enforce as a matter of civil law, mere promises and agreements to perform an action or engage in a future transaction. I just want to point out their formulation here is about enforcement. Jewish law has always had a great reluctance to enforce. The real point they want to make here is that Jewish law has a reluctance to impose an obligation as a matter of civil law. Not about enforcement, it's about imposing the duty in the first place. In any event, right. I think that as Cole points out, the proof text that they bring from like a Davar Shelo B'Li'olam is a really bad proof text. All that shows is that there's a legally valid way, and this is my comment over here, there's a legally valid way to effect transfers and a legally invalid way, I guess, to not effect transfers. So, yes, the Rambam does distinguish and say you always have to transfer a right in the here and now in order for the transfer to be valid. But that's just a rule of transfers. There always has to be some transfer of a normative right. It can't be a mere undertaking to transfer it in the future. I don't see how that shows that there's a general reluctance on the side of halacha to enforce contracts. look here. Mark, yeah.
Can you talk for a minute, because I think it's relevant to this, and I'm also curious in general, what is the difference between the halacha in Aramakna, Davar Shelo B'Li'olam, and the inability to perform a kinyan dvarim?
Yeah.
Rambam paskins them in very different places, but I don't quite see the difference.
Yeah.
The same intuition seems to lie behind them.
Yeah, they could be very related. I actually want to hold off on that broader discussion. Maybe it'll come up agap orcha here, but I want to kind of just focus on the article first, then we could talk broadly about the different halachas here. Adam, you have a hand up?
Yeah. I think it's interesting you're talking about enforce with this issue of kinyan dvarim, particularly doesn't bring up the question of whether maybe Broid is concerned about this, but whether there's some type of metaphysical obligation that even though it's not recognized through halachic contract theory, that theoretically exists between you and the person you've made this deal with. So even though we can't penalize you for it, we don't necessarily recognize it in the court, but you do have some type of moral obligation to hold it through if you're capable of.
Is that a verse in Kohelet?
Tova shelo tidor.
Favor of keeping your promises.
Yeah. Tova shelo tidor, masher tidor velo tishalem, right?
Rav Shalom, I'll just say, Rav Willig, I once contracted to learn 1,500 blot of Gemara at the Philly Yeshiva to like buy Chasen Brachos for Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky. And Rav Willig, when he was yelling at me for doing that, quoted that pasuk. That's how I know about that pasuk.
Right. Great. We'll put it in the biography, Cole.
Yeah. No, volume one.
Right, Adam. To your point, I think you could have solved these problems by saying, look, the halacha allows you to impose an obligation to sell a davar shelo b'li'olam, to contract future services, etc. But it's not going to enforce it in draconian ways, right? It'll make you pay some token damages for not doing it. You know, so I think you could have said, yeah, the halacha may not want to infringe or interfere with individual freedom by coercing you to perform. But you might say, but the halacha should recognize, even on their argument, the halacha should recognize a duty to perform and just impose some monetary penalty for not performing, right? So I think their inability to distinguish between enforcement and creating the obligations just clouds the argument that they're trying to make.
Your theoretical obligation to perform this case may have nothing to do with actual, transaction theory.
No, because I think you would need a legally valid transaction in order to impose the obligation. There wouldn't be an obligation absent that.
So I'm saying that there's no obligation, but it's a moral principle. Morally, you should fulfill that which you have promised.
No, I think if the halacha strikes down these kinyanim as being meaningless, like I promise to sell you all the wine that I'm going to make this season. If halachically that's not valid, then there'll be no obligation to perform because there just never was a halachic obligation that was created, Adam. That's my view.
Similar to the issue of, I forget what the Gemara is, but inviting someone to a meal when you in truth know that they're never going to come.
like a Gnevas Das.
It's deceptive in a way.
Are you like asking a Mycillus Yasharn question?
Partially. I'm asking, yeah, is there something like morally within the framework that, okay, these are not going to obligate you to do
right,
it?
So I think not. I think to the effect that these undertakings are just meaningless in Choshen Mishpat, they don't even generate the Mycillus Yasharn duties that you're grasping at. That's right.
Ouch.
Right.
I think it's probably not true.
Why do you think it's not true?
Because they're promises. They're just not legally, like, the problem. Because of what I said, they're not. They're promises. They don't latch onto a property interest sufficiently tightly.
No, so I don't think so. I think to the effect that these the thing they're trying to generate fails, there wouldn't even be some basic promise to uphold in these cases.
Are you trading on the view that the halakha obligates people to keep their promises that are legally effective for moral reasons because they're promises, and therefore that the absence of enforceability would indicate the absence of a promise occurring at all?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that what the halakha says in all of these cases is that there's no obligation. The attempted undertaking fails. And insofar as there's no obligation, there's not going to be any duty to perform whatsoever. It's like the thing that you attempted to undertake just was never undertaken.
Okay, all right, maybe we can have this. Okay, fine. Okay.
Yeah.
I disagree.
I want to make another observation about their... So after they talk about this inability to transfer a davar shelo bal yolam, so... Did you have a hand that I missed?
No.
Okay. After they talk about the inability to transfer davar shelo bal yolam, so they write, because in classical Jewish law, binding sale can only be effected by actually conveying title to the property and not merely by agreeing to perform a sale in the future, it makes sense that the law will not enforce a sale of assets, not yet owned by the seller, since a seller cannot convey title to property he does not yet own. Anybody have thoughts on that sentence? To think about this critically. Because in classical...
There's a charitable way of reading that.
Okay, but before I get to the charitable way, let me just get to the right way to read it.
Yeah. Well, can we talk about conveying title? What that practically means?
So they mean transfer. So they say, so I think the point here, this just brings out the problematic way that they're mixing together these different areas of halakha. And I think this is a nice point that Noah was bringing out. So yes, a transfer can only be affected by a valid transfer, right? But then they say that's why the law will not enforce a sale of assets not yet owned by the seller. There are really two separate issues here. One of them is, what's the halachic theory of property transfer? In just general legal categories, we'd think of that as an incident of property ownership. When has my transfer of property been affected? When has it been consummated? Who owns the object now? That's very different from the question of contract law, which is, have I undertaken a binding legal obligation to engage in a transfer of the object, to transfer the object to you? So they tell us that under the halacha's theory of property law, you can't transfer something that's not in your reshus. But that's kind of different from the question of the theory of contract law, which asks whether I could obligate myself to transfer something that I will get in the future. Everybody see that? So here, this statement just teases out that conceptual confusion. Because in classical Jewish law, a binding sale can only be affected by actually conveying title. So in order to transfer property, it has to be transferred. A contract, an agreement to perform a sale doesn't constitute a transfer. That's true. We know that an agreement, a contract to transfer, is not itself a transfer. But we're not interested in transfers. We're interested in the theory of contract, right? But this statement brings out that they don't recognize a difference between this idea of conveying title, just an actual transfer of property, and the agreement to perform a sale in the future, which is a contractual obligation to engage in a transfer. Very different ideas. Okay? Somebody had a hand. Adam. Adam had a hand.
Yeah. Does Halacha discuss a theoretical issue of, say, drawing up a contract to say, I will eventually in the future transfer this property, which I do currently have?
So, not really. That's what Cole, it's kind of a kin.
What?
So that's a standard, if you, it depends. Right, so that's what Cole's pointing out. This is the Kenyan environment show. I can't undertake to transfer in the future, but I could transfer it right now under the condition that certain things obtain. So if I say I'll transfer to you my car if the coronavirus epidemic subsides in the next month, that's not valid. But if I say I'm transferring it to you right now, a condition of the transfer is that the epidemic subside, that would be valid. So an undertaking to do something in the future is not valid. An undertaking, an obligation right now, the creation of an obligation in the present, subject to certain conditions obtaining, is valid.
Right, so that's interesting within itself, because in a classical law, to say that I will do something in the future, you are held accountable for such a thing.
Yeah, that's what the article is pointing out. The article is pointing out that the halacha seems to shy away from enforcing those kinds of future obligations.
Right, but it's interesting because it's not even contingent here on there existing such an object. I mean, the object exists.
Correct. As I pointed out in thing, you know, one reason you might say is because the halacha thinks there can't be real gemiras das. Right, so all transfers have to be executed with full intent. Gemiras das right now to do something later is problematic. Maybe for the reasons that Cole mentioned earlier about the continuity of personhood or something, that like my intent right now to transfer something later doesn't seize hold, doesn't latch on to that later thing to make it valid. Whenever there's a transfer, there has to be full gemiras das at the moment of the transfer. But my point is that could be a quirk of the halacha's theory of transfers, of property law, right? About how much gemiras das is needed to affect it. It may not take a stand at all under this theory, under this idea of what kinds of contractual undertakings can be accepted.
It seems that halacha doesn't really then have this idea of enforcement by transactions. What makes a transaction valid is the fact that the transaction has happened.
That's right. It's a distinction between transfer, property transfer, and contract. The halacha does recognize transfers. It's very weak, as this article is pointing out. I think this is the one virtue of the article, is that it does point out that the halacha has a weaker theory of contractual obligation than common law.
Right. Okay.
Right? I think that point of the article is right, the general observation. The specific...
Pushing back against that observation.
I agree with the general observation. I just think that their way of making the case and the conclusions that they attempt to draw are flawed. All right. Ben, you had a comment?
Yeah, just building off of what Adam was saying, that in that sentence, because in classical Jewish law at the end of the previous page, I think you're arguing that they're sort of conflating the difference between transfer of title and transfer of obligations in contracts, but I'm not sure they're doing that. They're only talking about transfer of obligations through contracts, and the mechanism for that in Jewish law is conveying title. But as you just noted to Adam, it's true that Judaism does not recognize transfer of contractual obligations for something in the future, as long as if it's not al tanai that something will change in the future.
Right. Right. I agree.
So
I agree with the general observation. I'm just making a narrow point here that this sentence conflates the theory of property transfer with the halacha's theory of contractual undertakings. So I agree with the
gen. Where does transferring title come up in that sentence, other than title is the Jewish mechanism for creating contractual obligations?
So I don't think that title would be the mechanism for generating contractual obligations. I think this sentence brings out the gap between the proof text that they're bringing and the argument that they're hanging on it. The proof text that they're bringing are from the fact that in order to transfer property, the transfer has to be fully valid and executed at the moment of the kinyan, right? That's an aspect of the halacha's theory of property transfer. How that bears on the halacha's theory of contract is just not taken up by the halachos of property transfer. It doesn't bear on it at all. And so, Ben, I don't see you here. Oh, I see you now. The issue here is that in this sentence, you see that they conflate. They don't appreciate that there's a difference between these two different categories. How a binding sale can be executed, meaning how property can be transferred, conveying title, is just not, it doesn't bear on what kind of agreements you could undertake to perform in the future, right? The latter thing is about what contracts can be created. The former thing is about how the halacha allows you to transfer title.
Please, in my reading, the phrase binding sale means contractual obligation. Binding, you're being obligated to an eventual sale.
Right.
Or sale now. So maybe that's how I was reading binding sale, is not dealing with actual giving over property.
Right,
As much as obligation to contract.
Right. Yeah, I hear that. A binding sale, you mean, is like an obligation to sell. Can only be affected by actually conveying title to the property. So it makes sense, therefore, that the law will not enforce a sale of assets not yet owned by the seller, since a seller cannot convey title. But Ben, how do you read the end of the sentence?
That not merely agreeing to what, after the yellow?
Yeah. Read for me this whole sentence. Like, so what? There's a because, right? Because this, it makes sense that since a seller cannot convey title to the property he has not yet owned.
Right, because I guess by law not enforcing, it's that the contract, the binding sale, never was binding to begin with. Because it only could have become binding, theoretically binding, meaning obligating, if there was actually title transferred. And Devar Shelo Ba'al Olam, there's no title to be transferred because it doesn't exist. I mean, you can't enforce it because it doesn't exist. It never became a binding sale in the first place at the time of contract.
Right. So I think that here's another way of putting my point, Ben. They start off here in the beginning of the sentence by saying, because the halakha doesn't have a general theory of contract, right? You can only transfer property through kinyanim, through property transfers. It makes sense that the law will not enforce the sale of assets not yet owned by the seller. Okay. I guess my point, another way of putting my point, is that it's an open question as to what kind of property transfers the halacha will allow, right? Some Tanaim even think that the halacha does allow you to transfer a davar shelo ba'al olam, right? As a theory of property transfer. And so I don't really see how they make the move from their observation about the limits of contract law to therefore being satisfied or explaining the limits of property transfer law. They think these are just like one issue. The fact that, maybe this is Cole's point from earlier, they think the fact that the halacha doesn't allow you to be Makne Adavar Shelo Bali Olam is just the same idea as the halacha not allowing you to undertake a future obligation. And I would say, well, no, and this is my answer to Cole maybe, the idea of a kinyan dvarim is an issue of the theory of contracts. I cannot undertake a future obligation to do something. It's a theory of what kinds of obligations I could undertake right now. The issue of ena d'makne devar shelo bali olam, you might say, is a feature of property transfer law, which says that maybe you can't have gemiras das on an object that's not in your rishus. There is no item to be transferred. And you see, this sentence shows that they don't appreciate the difference between these different areas of halacha. Ben, do you hear that?
Can I bring us back to Noah's observation from earlier?
Yeah.
Noah's observation, which I think is very important, is that Rebbe Broid, at least in this article, isn't talking like a brisker. Which means, for me, plumbing the subtle depths of these points has less to do with conceptual clarity and more to do with rhetoric. What are Roy and Wiener trying to get at? They're trying to draw a contrast between halacha and common law. In common law, one is able to contract on future goods. In halacha, that doesn't work because you can't actually transfer title, according to the Rabbanan, because it doesn't exist yet. And you also can't create a binding kinyan dvarim because, according to the Rambam that they cite, that's not possible. So the goal is to draw this contrast, and they're doing so by sort of eliminating the two ways that one could understand a contract to future goods in halacha and showing how some version of that does exist according to
It could be. I guess what you're saying is that we can't even hold them to the standard of consistent and rigorous analysis if they're just trying to make some broad sweeping point, right? Is that what you're saying?
No, my point has less to do with they're not, you know, oh, they're like, it's this cute little article, and so we don't need to actually read it seriously. I think that they're not trying to make any meaningful claim about why a kinyan dvarim doesn't work. Or rather, they're trying to make the claim that it has to do with the failure of a freedom from contract.
Yeah.
And this whole analysis, the Rishol Ba Olam, is only there to draw a contrast to common law.
Okay, maybe.
So they're not making any conceptual claim about it. They're just arguing, look, okay, a kinyan dvarim doesn't exist, and according to the Rabbanan, you can't transfer title, and therefore it's not possible to transfer these things. And that's what that sentence that you and Ben were debating.
Okay, let's see more formulations, Yair, and tell me if you still agree with that reading. So
yeah, I disagree.
Well,
I invoked your name.
Right. Okay. Good.
I know. That's why I wanted to tell you that.
So look here on page 51. So they say. The Talmud does not recognize a binding agreement to make a sale absent the actual transferring of the title. Maybe this is nitpicking here, obviously actually transferring the title is not a binding agreement to make a sale. It just is doing a sale, right? So here again, you see this conflation of the contract law and the property law. Right? The Talmud does not recognize a binding agreement to make a sale absent the actual transferring of the title. Transferring of the title is never going to be a binding agreement to make a sale. It just is the actual sale. It's not an agreement to make a sale. Again, one being an issue of property law, the other being a kind of a contract law issue. Let's look here at the next sentence. By contrast, contract law in the common law system shows absolutely no reluctance to enforce contracts for the future sale of goods which the seller does not yet possess at the contract time. Anybody have a problem with this sentence? Or just an observation conceptually? By contrast? Not the comment that I put in there. Donnie, you have an observation about this sentence or... Contract law shows absolutely no reluctance to enforce contracts for the future of sale goods. Yeah, here?
Yeah, it's the same recognize and force.
Yes.
That you noted before.
Exactly, right? The distinction here is not between the halacha not recognizing such contracts and the common law enforcing them, right? The real issue, enforcement, they shouldn't even be talking about enforcement here. The real question is, are these kinds of contractual obligations recognized? Under common law, yes. Under halacha, no. So I think here you see it. They're not sensitive to this important distinction, right? They show no reluctance to enforce such contracts. That's not really the chiddush. The chiddush here is about how common law recognizes them. And you'll see, if it was just this one sentence, it wouldn't bother me. But you see throughout the article, they're not sensitive to that important distinction. Okay, here we get their speculation on page 52. Why Jewish law, in contrast to the common law, shrink from enforcing binding? Notice again, why Jewish law, in contrast, shrink from enforcing binding promises to sell, right? Again, it's not about why we're shrinking from enforcing them. It's really about why the halacha refuses to recognize them. And I think they keep slipping into this language of enforcement because they're pumping the intuition that contracts take away rights, contracts take away free will. That's really only true if you pump the ideas about enforcement. It's not necessarily true about just imposing an obligation. Having an obligation to do X doesn't take away from your free choice to do not X. They keep slipping into this idea of enforcement because they want to tap your intuitions about how contracts take away free will. And I think that's mostly true about enforcement, not about not about imposing obligations. Okay? So their speculation is that this is best understood in light of the broader rabbinic disdain for enforcing personal undertakings to perform specific acts as a matter of civil law. What strikes you about that statement? So I really have two separate observations here. But if you guys have a comment separate from my comments, feel free to share it also on this statement. First, does anybody notice anything about this statement in terms of the enforcement recognition, enforcement imposing obligation distinction? Not in my notes here. Adam, you have a hand?
Yeah, it seems to suggest that there may actually theoretically be an obligation. It's just that there's rabbinic disdain to enforce it.
Okay, let me put that idea a little differently. Who did we lose? We lost a few people dropped out just now, right?
Wait, before you explain it, can you give that framing again? I couldn't hear you.
Yeah. If you look here at this sentence, right? So notice how they start talking about why halacha shies away from enforcing binding promises to sell. Right? And they say it's best explained by the fact that the halacha generally doesn't enforce personal undertakings to perform specific acts as a matter of civil law, okay? And by that, they mean that in our sugya of Schiras Polim, the halacha is very reticent to compel people to perform under a contract, right? Kili b'nei Yisrael avadim, z'chus po'al achzor. So what I want to point out here is not only do they shrink, they fall into the language of enforcement, the halacha not enforcing a davar shelo b'li'olam, as opposed to the halacha not recognizing that as a valid transfer. They say, the halacha not enforcing a davar shelo b'li'olam is the same as the halacha not enforcing compelling performance on schiras po'alim. So I just want to point out that there's a huge difference because in the ena demakna davar shelo b'li'olam case, there's no halachic obligation. The sale has not been consummated, regardless of whether the halacha is going to enforce it. In the Schiras Polim case, there is a duty to perform, just on their view, the halacha is not going to compel performance. So it's problematic that they think that the halacha of not recognizing an obligation in case X is the same as the halacha recognizing an obligation in case Y, but not compelling performance on it. And to my mind, those are very different issues. Cases where the halacha recognizes an obligation but won't compel performance, and cases where the halacha doesn't recognize an obligation altogether. I also want to point out, and I'll take some more hands, that, you know, they say that the halacha shrinks away from enforcing personal undertakings, but I just want to point out that in all sorts of areas of civil law, the halacha does enforce performance. In Nezikin, the halacha could compel Tashlumin. In Ishus, a lot of Rishonim think that the Beis Din could compel a husband to find a job, to work in order to support his wife. In Kinyanim, the halacha will compel you to make good on a Kinyan. If you sold something, they're going to force you to go through with the sale. if I sell my house to you, the halacha is going to force me to actually transfer the property once I did the sale, right? So, of course, there's compelling performance in a lot of cases. Yet they say that there's a broad rabbinic disdain for enforcing personal undertakings to perform specific acts as a matter of civil law. Remember also we saw the Tosefta, that the halacha will even compel the poor barber of a town that needs people's hair cut before Yontif. They're going to compel the barber to stay and cut people's hair, right? So it's not clear to me that Freud and Wiener are justified in saying that there's a general pattern in halacha that it shies away from compelling performance. It's true that in Schiras Polim, the remedies in the Gemara aren't always kfiya and, you know, there's this chus pol lachzor. But I don't think that justifies their broad conclusion here that the halacha shies away from compelling performance when we have all these other cases of kfiya. Okay, Adam, you have a hand, and let's take some other thoughts also. Adam, go for it.
When I think about it more, I retract it because I know it's now it's a specific civil law. So.
Yeah, okay. Fair. So the hand goes away. Donnie has a hand, then Noah.
So I think I agreed with everything you said except for the barber case.
Okay.
Just because that is that enforcing personal undertakings? Because in that case, that wouldn't really be... Is that a personal undertaking, at least in the context of the case?
It's interesting. I mean, in one way, you could spin it as a personal undertaking. I see what you're saying. So I think the idea is that if I set up as the barber in town, so I create an expectation that I'm going to be available to give haircuts and supply everyone's needs before Yontif. I think if I had been the barber in the town and I put up a sign saying, you know, a sign 3 months before Yontif saying, guys, I'm leaving 2 weeks before the holiday starts, get your haircuts before then, I don't think they'd be able to compel me to remain. I think the reason why they're able to compel me to remain is because the expectation was set that I was going to be available to perform these things. So you're right, it's not an undertaking in this explicit sense, but it is an undertaking in this more implicit way.
Okay, yeah, I hear that.
Yeah, thank you, Donnie. Noah.
Yeah, I was going to make a similar point to you, that he undermines himself by bringing in this like rabbinic intuition to like not enforce civil law when there clearly is a lot of halakhic precedent for enforcement. I'm kind of curious to what light the sugya of Kofin Omidat Stone would bring into the larger question of kfiya and like reticence for Beit Din or Chazal to enforce normal behavior that isn't morally deviant.
Kofin Omidat Stone has nothing to do with this.
No, I don't mean our sugya of Poel, but just in general, the rabbinic intuition for kfiya, and because Kofin Omidat Stone relates to like really bad moral behavior.
Kofin Omidat Stone relates to costless exertions. It's where it doesn't matter to you. There's zero cost. The classic case of Kofin Omidat Stone is two fields side by side. Your brother would inherit next to his, and you wouldn't inherit next to either of your fields. So your Kofin Omidat Stone says you have to give your brother the field that's next to his, because to you it doesn't make a difference. But it has nothing to... Kofin Omidat Stone, the Rishon... It's like the most overused... Sorry. When we did this last year, I had a fit. When the Rambam is very narrow about the case, the Rishonei Ashkenaz go nuts with Kofin. It really didn't have anything to do with this.
Okay.
I mean, I based on what you're saying, I mean, like, I disagree and think that you just reinforced that point about the nature of Kofin Omidat Stone, but I would say that I agree with you that your analysis of Kofin Omidat Stone minimizes the role of kfiya in this larger discussion. So I'll leave it there.
Yeah, I mean, I think, Noah, you're raising... We don't have to quibble about Kofin Omidat Stone itself. I think the more general point that you're raising is that we see all sorts of cases of kfiya in the halachos of civil law in general, right? Where the halacha doesn't shy away from compelling certain kinds of performance, whether it's negative performance or positive performance. The halacha could compel me to not have my sheep trespassing on your property. Right? I mean, all these easy cases and the cases that I'm pointing out as well show that the halacha is totally happy to compel performance in cases, right? No, I take that to be your main point.
Absolutely, yeah. That's exactly what I was getting
at. Right, so I agree. I mean, that's the point that I'm making as well, that their article just conveniently forgets that the halacha is high on compelling performance in other cases. So I definitely agree with that observation. Let me move on to this next sentence here, which I think is interesting. So they start moving in the middle of this page to, this is page 52, to this analogy with debtor's prison. They say the common law is very happy to imprison people for not paying their debts. You know, every Dickens novel is usually filled with people in debtor's prison. I think David Copperfield in particular has some good stuff on debtor's prisons. And they say the halacha always shied away from this, right? The halacha would never put somebody into bondage because they owed a debt. So they say common law accepted and embraced the penalties of debtor's prison. In Jewish law, such deep restrictions on personal freedom as a consequence of financial obligations were strictly limited to situations where the obligation came about through some criminal wrong, such as theft, if the resulting debt cannot be repaid by the guilty perpetrator. So they show that the halacha wasn't as enthusiastic about putting people into bondage for not paying their obligations. And so they're just trying to point out that as a general point, the common law was more willing to impose onerous penalties on people for not performing than the halacha is, right? But notice, what does this relate to? What does this relate to? Is this about the kinds of obligations people have, or is this about how we compel performance on obligations that people have? So, Donnie, it sounds like you have a thought on this.
Oh, well, no, I'm muted.
No, you're good. We hear you.
Just making sure. It sounds like this is completely about compelling instead of about recognition.
Exactly. This thing just points out that the halacha is not going to impose a draconian remedy for a financial obligation. Sure, that sounds sensible. But this has nothing to do with what kinds of obligations the halacha is willing to impose in the first place, right? This article is really about, well, what obligations, what's the halacha's theory of contractual obligation? And so bringing a proof from how the halacha shies away from draconian remedies, I think is a poor way of establishing what kinds of contractual obligations exist in the first place. Does everybody agree with that point? Yair?
I don't agree with that point. I think what they're trying to get at with this line is that the reason this draconian measure is inappropriate is because it limits personal freedom and compels performance of specific actions.
But notice this doesn't perform this is putting somebody...
Being a debtor slave would involve performance of actions to fulfill financial obligations, which is not okay. It's not about whether or not we recognize the financial obligation. When you steal and are sold as a slave, it's unambiguous that we recognize your financial obligation. It's about whether we'll compel you to do that.
Well, we'll compel you to make good on the debt, right? The halacha, if you have any property in your house, the bezin will come in, they'll take a mashkon, they'll give it to the guy. So there's a certain kind of compelling performance. Just the halacha doesn't go so far as to lock people in prison for not paying their debts. I don't see how that bears on whether the halacha recognizes certain kinds of contractual obligations in the first place.
It's not. What it's discussing is this broader ethos of unwillingness to compel specific performance of actions. And one way that we won't compel you to act is we won't compel you to work to make money to pay off debts.
Okay, I don't know if debtor's prison, Cole probably knows more about this.
Debtor's prison is a bad mashal. Better bondage is a better one.
Okay, but,
What did you say?
I hear. Meaning, the halacha won't sell you into servitude to make money in order to pay off the debt.
Which is because they won't make you do things in order to fulfill financial obligations.
Okay, I would just say this is more, you could interpret this away as just being a theory of debt, that a debt in general, kind of like bankruptcy, is something to be repaid if you have assets to repay. But absent having the assets to pay, then there's just no means of satisfying the obligation. That's how I would interpret it, Yair. Anybody else have thoughts on this? Anybody agree with me? Anybody want to take a stand on me versus Yair? And Donnie, whose side are you on in this? Oh, you're muted.
That's exactly how I was going to be political and not weigh in.
Okay, you didn't want to take a stand. Cole, you have thoughts on this?
Not vigorous ones.
Okay. Let me just make a few other points. On page 53, so they say that the rabbis were exceedingly averse to the notion of potentially imposing restrictions on personal action as a matter of civil obligation, even a defaulting party, and therefore shirked the notion of allowing parties to enter into binding contractual promises to perform particular acts. So I guess the question to my mind is, how is, if this theory is right, so shouldn't the halacha, like, not, if I sell something to you, so why should the halacha bind me to the sale, right? Isn't that imposing restrictions on personal action, right? So why is my selling my car to you today any less of a restriction, and not being able to get it back, any less of a restriction than entering into an agreement to sell it to you tomorrow? So if the rabbis were exceedingly averse to the notion of potentially imposing restrictions on personal action, then, and that's why they're not allowing people to enter into binding contractual promises, why is this uniquely true of obligations to do things in the future? Why isn't it true also of things that are valid today, which thereby impose certain obligations in the future? If I sell you my car today, there's an obligation for me to see that transfer through tomorrow, right? Maybe to deliver it tomorrow. And so I just don't see how this proposition uniquely explains the halacha's shirking away from future agreements to perform, but while not posing problems for even just the standard kinyanim in halacha.
Well, you might say that conceptually, I think there's a difference between an executory contract and a sale. The difference is that, strictly speaking, sales don't require performance. They simply require a sales are totally abstract. You transfer the title to a particular piece of property. You don't have to physically do anything. Whereas a binding executory agreement, I think, they're all contracts. A sale is obviously a kind of contract. But the thing that's permitted by the halacha, sales are permitted by the halacha. I think the executory contracts objection, though, that they, or the qualification they have is true, that, like, promising to do a particular thing, in Blackstone's phrase, like, literally to do, like, to, you know, locomote and exert yourself physically, that the halacha is much less willing to allow you to do.
And you think, like, even in a standard sale, there's no obligation to do?
Strictly speaking, sales do not require, like, lechazik v'kani, the kone is the one doing all the stuff. You need a maisa, but there's no contract. You're done with a sale as soon as you make it. Assuming there are no tanayim involved, whatever it is. But an executory agreement, the making it is just the beginning. Then you have to go out and, like, do something. And that the halacha maybe is less comfortable with, although given the area which is the basis of the controversy among the Rishonim about, you know, haskala, so the significance of a haskala.
Yeah.
So malacha.
Yeah, good. Kinyonim, maisa kinyon on sfiras poalim.
Kinyon, exactly. The Ravid and the Ritva against the Maharik.
Yeah.
So, you know, the halacha has a strong desire to assimilate executory agreements into the world of sales. And by the way, it seems according to...
So Cole, I'm going to correct you on that, because I don't think the right way to put it is assimilation of executory agreements into sales, as opposed to just viewing executory agreements as transfers of right.
A property right.
Yeah. They're transfers of... I'm not sure if...
That's an uptown word for sale.
Well, next Chabur, I'll talk about... see, reading these articles makes me slip into class. For next Chabur, I want to actually... I'll bring in some ideas about contract being related to property. And you'll see Grotius has this idea as well. So I think it could still be distinct. It's not a transfer of a good, but it's a transfer of what a lot of philosophers call the normative right.
This is Aleph Beis in Hofeld. There's no such thing as a transfer of a good. Don't be ridiculous. There's a bundle of normative rights associated between two people, associated with, you know,
right.
a particular.
That's right.
There's no difference.
That's right. It brings the contract and property very closely together. We'll talk about that.
Interesting thing that, and it might be related to this, you know, here's an interesting tension to think about. So you might have thought that, you might have thought that the view of employment that involves, like, property, having property in another human being, okay, which the Ravid and the Ritva seem to have against the Balei Tosfos, you might have thought that that was pretty close to Avdus. But maybe what's even closer to Avdus is a binding executory agreement. At least in the case of... having property in a particular person, maybe then you could say, really, you have property in the output of the labor or something like that. A binding executory agreement that requires performance. There, you're conceptually, it's just tracking like what you do. So it could be this is a way to like save the property interest view of the employment contracts in halacha from being like too close to avdus. You could say like, well, they're all, you know, however you're going to cut it, it's pretty close to avdus. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I see what you're getting at. I think we should take it up in the next habura here.
Okay.
And so, guys, what I want, I think we did a good job discussing the article today. I want to spend probably at least the first half of the next habura discussing Broyd and Wiener's analysis of our sugya, of Schiras Poalim, specifically how they see the different remedies, how they interpret the different remedies, which remedies they leave out, which parts of the sugya they spin as Ikar and which parts of the sugya they spin as Tafel. So I want to take that up in the next Chabura. And I want to wrap up the discussion of the article and hopefully begin our discussion of Ones. We'll see how things go next week. But I want to continue taking a close look at this article. And then our next sugya is the topic of Ones. The question is, do we want to try to get in a chabura before Pesach, like early next week? Is that something guys would want or something guys would not want?
Okay. That'd be great.
Well,
I'm happy for that.
I would want it.
Yeah, I think since we're not in YU anyway, we might as well keep going, right? Yeah, Donnie doesn't look so happy about it. Donnie's like, oh no, this is... Oh, okay. So if we want, we could even go through Pesach. I leave it up to you guys, since no one's doing anything anyway.
No. We're not going through Pesach. I have so much work to do. It's unbelievable.
Okay, fine. So.
Yeah, I got so many beaches to go to. That's a problem.
Okay, fine. So maybe we'll do one Chabura. We'll definitely do Thursday, and then maybe we'll do one early next week. We'll see on guys' availability. Okay, yeah, Shakach, everybody. So next Chabura will...
Stay on a sec.
You want me to stay on?
Yeah,
I can stay on a sec.
limits only for pastoral.
That's right. I'll stop the recording here.
The recording.